No, he won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No, we won't take it.
Good morning and welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. You know, what a week we had in Wisconsin. Congratulations to all of you that participated in the recall. You've really helped to start to move our state forward. That song that started out, she was a recall song, the opening song. She was one of the recall songs, and as it was fading out to get me to talk, she said, no, we can't take it, we're going to stand our ground, and that's exactly what we did in Wisconsin this week. We stood our ground, we said no more to Governor Walker, and we're going to start taking our state back and start moving it in a direction that we feel this state needs to go in. But we have a great show coming up for you today. In the first hour, we have Keith Schmidt from Grassroots North Shore to discuss progressive radio and the new direction for the grassroots movement. And we're followed by Yuri Raskin with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. In our second hour, I have a recorded interview with Chris Liebenthal, the writer for the blog Cognitive Dissonance, to discuss the John Doe investigation. And we'll finish off the second hour talking to Linda Freeman with United Wisconsin. I also want to talk about the recall and would love to hear, actually we're going to talk about the recall because United Wisconsin was so instrumental in getting that recall to happen. But so were the volunteers and the people on the ground and the county coordinators and everyone who signed. Everyone participated in this. This was a true democratic process. And if you have a story about the recall, if you were a coordinator, if you were a signer, if you were just a volunteer and stood out there, I really like to hear your story. So when we talk to Lynn, I want you to call in and tell us, just talk about it. Just air your feelings because this is such an important event that happened, and it was just amazing. There's really no other word around to go with it. It was just truly amazing. We also have a live discussion on blogtalkradio.com. You can post your comments or questions, or you can call in at 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. Now, before I get to Keith Schmidt, I ran into John Nichols at the Monona Terrace on Tuesday before we turned in the petitions to the GAB, and I got about a 13-minute interview with him, and I really wanted to start to show off with this. So here's John Nichols. I am here talking with John Nichols from The Nation and one of the biggest voices and supporters of the recall. I don't want to know the number, but what is your feel after covering this, after talking to people? What is your feel on where you think the number is going to fall?
The number of signatures that will be filed in Wisconsin today, January 17, 2011, will be the largest portion of a state's population ever to petition for the removal of a governor in the history of the United States. This will be unprecedented. We will make absolute history. This is Guinness Book of World Records stuff. And that number will be in the range of 1 million. Whether they get a little above, a little below, we'll see. And there will also be in the range of 850,000 for Rebecca Clayfish. There will additionally be about another 100,000 for the various state Senate races. And so when all is said and done, and we, you know, they'll give you a precise figure eventually, but we will be talking about in the range of 2 million signatures being submitted to the Government Accountability Board today. That has never happened in a political moment like this anywhere in the history of the country. So Wisconsin has once again proven to be exactly what I've always believed it to be, which is the most purely and genuinely progressive and committed state in this republic. And you know, Harriet Tubman used to say, follow the North Star when slaves were heading north. And, you know, I look at that map of the United States and I look at where north would be on the map. It's out in the middle of the country, up near the Canadian border, up near Lake Superior. That's Wisconsin. And I happen to think that what's happening today in Wisconsin is going to inspire people across this country. I think there will be single moms in Florida and, you know, factory workers in Maine and, you know, small business owners in Michigan who will look at what happened in Wisconsin today, and they will say, we can do it here. We can take down a reactionary and destructive governor. We can remove that person from office. We can change the direction of our state via referendums or recalls or initiatives or whatever tool we need. because if Wisconsin can do it, the rest of the country can. So what's happening today is a big deal, not just for those of us who want our state to be what it has always been and a little bit better, but also for the whole country, and that's why there's such excitement about Wisconsin right now. I just did Ed Schultz's radio show. We had people calling in from all over the United States, and they were just thrilled. They were beside themselves with excitement at what's going to happen here today. And I think we should take that in and recognize that we're not fighting just for ourselves. We're fighting for the whole country. And if we do this right, if we file these signatures, if we run a great campaign, and if we change the direction of this state, there is simply no question that will resonate all the way to the White House, through every state in the country. And at the end of this year, it will be said that America is a different place and a better place because of what Wisconsin did.
And once again, Wisconsin is the progressive torch for the United States. Now, we did it in a less amount of time, having to do more signatures than most people, and we really set a precedent. And not only did we set a precedent with the signature collection, but how we did it and the fact that the movement started in Wisconsin and then it spread out. You saw it in Ohio, you saw it in Michigan, and it seems to be we're starting that movement again. Do you think that this is a movement that will continue well past Walker getting out of office?
Well, it absolutely will. That's the whole point of it. The thing that has destroyed our politics in this country, and frankly the thing that really is the number one reason why Scott Walker is the governor of Wisconsin, why John Kasich is the governor of Ohio, why all of these reactionary governors have come in, is not because of Citizens United, and it's not because of the Tea Party, it's not because of the state of the economy. It's because an awfully lot of grassroots Americans forgot the great lesson of Robert M. La Follette. La Follette preached that democracy is a life. Doesn't just occur on election day. You can't just elect somebody good. You can't put Barack Obama in the presidency in 2008 and walk away. You have to practice it every single day. And the experience that we've been through in Wisconsin, since Walker's election, but really since February of 2011, when the anti-labor initiatives began, the experience that Wisconsin has been through has, I think, caused people to recognize how right La Follette was. My sense is that everything will be different as a result of this. People 50 years from now will remember this struggle. And you say, well, you know, how does that happen? Well, take a look. 50 years after the Civil War, the people who fought the Civil War still got together and talked about what they had accomplished, that they had banished the sin of human bondage from the North American continent. 50 years after the progressive movement rose, the old progressives in Wisconsin would get together and talk about how they radically transformed America, created an elected U.S. Senate, transformed Wisconsin, made it the laboratory of democracy from having been, you know, a corporate cesspool before that. This people remember when they're a part of something transformational. It imprints on them. There are little kids. I was just with a 9-year-old kid just a couple minutes ago. I mean, 50 years from now, he's only going to be 59. He won't be that old. That kid could live to the 22nd century, and I will guarantee you that if he does, he will remember these moments and this time. He will tell his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren that I stood in front of the Capitol, that I marched, that I helped to petition, that I campaigned, that I transformed a state, and that the whole of the United States and people as far away on this planet as you can imagine, people in Egypt and India and China, will say, wow, there's this place called Wisconsin where a million people stood up and said, no more. We do not wait till the next election. We don't wait until somebody gives us permission to change. We do it now. We take our power. That's a power given us by the progressives, but it's also a power that runs much deeper. When the Chilean poet Victor Jara was imprisoned by those who overthrew Allende in 1973. Victor Jara sang a song in the stadium in Santiago that translates from Spanish to, take hold of your destiny, the future begins today. When people realize that, when they realize that they have a destiny, and if they take hold of it and believe that this is the start, they can change anything. Well, that's what Wisconsin has done this year. We took hold of our destiny. We recognize that the future begins today. And it happens to be that on this day, January 17th, you're going to see the better part of 2 million signatures filed with the Government Accountability Board seeking to change the direction of this state. You know, it's almost it's the full realization of what Victor Jara told those people in that stadium, and frankly, it's the full realization of what Jefferson and Jackson and Lincoln and La Follette and Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy and all the way through, all those people said. You know, all the lofty words, they're real, and we're part of it. It's I find it almost unimaginable that I was lucky enough, that you were lucky enough to live in this moment.
Well, what's the next step? You said the grassroots are what rose up and remembered, hey, this is not where we want to go. How can we stop this from reoccurring? This seems to be a 100-year reoccurrence. They were fighting the same fight we fought 100 years ago with Governor La Follette standing up and saying those words. What's the next step to make sure that we don't have to have this repeat again, that we can just keep staying on track and progressively be better?
Well, Sarah, the answer is the same as it was in La Follette's time. We will always be in what La Follette referred to as the old fight. I hate to tell you. I mean, that's just a painful reality. I wish I could tell you that there's some sort of rule we could put in, some sort of structure we could put in that we'd never have this happen. But as long as there's greed, as long as there are players who believe they can game the system in a way that gives them more wealth, more power, we will always be in that old fight. It's a fight that caused people to go to a boat in Boston Harbor and throw the tea off, the good tea party, back in 1773. It's that fight that caused kids from, you know, Rock and Lafayette and Jefferson and Dane counties and Walworth County, Kenosha County and Racine, to suit up in uniforms, blue uniforms in the Civil War and go and fight slavery. I mean, we've always had to do it. Sometimes we've had to do it with guns, and that's a terrible reality. Sometimes we've been able to do it with a petition and a pen. But it's an ongoing struggle. It has high points and low points, but we lose only when we forget to fight. And when we kind of let it temp down, when we think we've settled things, that's when the other side gets its upper hand. It always is the case. It's never been different. And so if we recognize this as an ongoing struggle, we never have to worry. But it's not a law you can pass, and it's not a candidate you can elect. It's in your heart and in your soul. I mean, you wake up in the morning and say, well, okay, we got to fight this fight. And it doesn't mean you have to do it every day. You don't have to be a bore or some sort of somebody that you know, doesn't talk about anything else. You can be into rock and roll. You can go cheer on the Packers. You can love your kids and, you know, play in the park. But you have to, someplace in you have this default position that, you know, when you hear the call, you got to go to the Capitol. You go. And you march in the snow and in the cold. And then you take your hits. You lose some things. You come back again. You run your recalls in the summer of 2011. You win some. You lose some. You have people tell you, oh, you didn't do it. You can't do it. And, you know, it's time to retire, time to let Governor Walker do what he wants. And you say, no, we're going to come back again. And you go out and you do the most historic petition drive in the history of the Republic. That's just what happened. And then sometime this summer, this late spring, Governor Walker will be defeated in a recall election. There'll be big headlines. People will be very excited. A lot of people say, well, now I can go on vacation. And they can. There's no doubt. We're not going to brutalize people. But at the end of the day, when they get back from that vacation, they better read the paper. They better listen to the radio. They better go online because there's going to be another fight. And that doesn't wear me out. I don't feel tired by that. I think that's a wonderful thing. When you know what your life is about, and some people find it in religion, some people find it in politics, I think a lot of people find it in both. But the bottom line is that if you know in your heart and in your soul, I got to get up this morning, I got to take a look at the world, got to make sure if things aren't right, I'm going to try and set them right. If we do that, Wisconsin will never get in this mess again. Never. And we will never have another, you know, interloper from Kansas who, you know, never finished college and never ever really took in the Wisconsin values as our governor. That'll never happen again. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to be born in Wisconsin to be a perfect governor. We've had a few that weren't. But what it does mean is if you're going to be governor of Wisconsin, you have to get what this state is about. We pay taxes. We want our schools to be the best in the country. We want our services to be the best in the country. We want to always be number one. We don't want to diminish ourselves down to compete with other states. And if we have a governor, as we currently do, that proposes that, he is not proposing something that's good for Wisconsin. He's proposing to take the greatest state in this union and to make it a little bit more like other states. I don't want Wisconsin to be like other states. I want Wisconsin to be exactly what Robert M. La Follette said it is, the greatest hope for the whole republic. And today I think there's going to be an awful lot of people in Oregon and California and Texas and Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, we're going to look at what's happening in Wisconsin and go say, you know what? It is. It is. It's about as hopeful a place as we got.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate all that you've done and the voice that you've given this struggle. I know you're going to continue, but thank you and keep up the good fight.
Nothing that I've done would mean a thing if there weren't hundreds of thousands of people that went out and did this struggle. Nobody's interested in anything I say except that I'm talking about people in Wisconsin doing amazing things. So thank you. And we'll be thanking a lot of people today, and it will all be deserved.
That was John Nichols from The Nation, and we talked before we went to the GAB and turned in the petitions on Tuesday at Monona Terrace. Now, up next is Keith Schmidt. I'd like to welcome him to the Sarah Schultz Show. Hey, Keith, you are from Grassroots North Shore.
Right, Sarah. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm super. Thanks for asking.
Good. Well, before we get into the discussion here, I want you to tell a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with Grassroots North Shore.
Well, like a lot of people, I was interested for quite some time in politics. In fact, when I grew up in Port Washington, my house, my parents got both the Journal, Milwaukee Journal and Milwaukee Sentinel. We talked about politics a lot, and we were probably one of the few Democrats in Port Washington. Went through the 60s, dabbled a little bit in protests and whatever, but then settled down and got married and raised a family and the whole bit and wasn't involved. And then Howard Dean came along in 2004. And the interesting thing was I met so many people that would say, you know, I'm 40 years old and I haven't been involved in politics. I'm 50 years old and I haven't been involved in politics. And so what was really great about that movement was it got people out to get involved. And the other thing, of course, as we all know, was that the Dean campaign was probably the first one that used the Internet on a widespread basis. And so people who really got involved in the campaign got to know people from all across the country. And so when the primary came to Wisconsin in April of 2004, I got to meet a lot of those people. And so after the scream, the gas ran out of his campaign, and then he shut it down. But before the Democratic convention in Boston that year, a bunch of us wanted to get together and talk about, or just get together because we knew each other as a big family across the country. So my wife talked me into going out and seeing my friends out there. So I did. Expecting it would be just a big party and we would drink beer and talk war stories. Well, it turned out that there was a group there doing a session on forming your own political organization, a group called Latinos for Democracy. So I sat through the session, got inspired, came back, got in touch with a bunch of my friends in Shorewood, and we decided let's try to do this. Let's see if we can set up an operation here. So we called a meeting on the Tuesday night of the Republican convention, and lo and behold, 100 people showed up. So we signed them all up, and that weekend, we organized a canvass out of Shorewood. And so it turned out that somebody else came to that meeting who was from Whitefish Bay, and she organized a group up in Whitefish Bay. And you're outstate, but the reputation of Whitefish Bay is it's a rather conservative. Whitefish Bay is rather conservative, and referred to as White Folks Bay. Well, at that first meeting, 250 people showed up, and so we pulled them into the group, and then we picked up Fox Point and Brown Deer, and so that's how we worked the campaign until we got to the last 2 weeks, and then it was done out of the main headquarters downtown. So after the election, we kind of looked around and thought, well, this really worked out well. Why don't we keep this going? So we organized Grassroots North Shore, and we kind of organized it around the Dean model in that we connect people through the Internet, but of course we do a lot of boots-to-the-ground type activities, such as having monthly meetings, and of course we get involved with elections. And so what's happened over, we've been doing this since 2004. What's happened over the last 8 years when we get to every election cycle, we kept getting better and better in terms of organizing the campaigns out of the North Shore. So now pretty much the way it works is when a campaign comes around, we find the office space, we get the volunteers, and then the Democrats bring in a staffer or two, and then that's how we run the campaign. In fact, the recall, we totally staffed the office. I mean, we had one staffer from the Democratic Party, Jeremy Mitchell, who did an excellent job, by the way. We raised the money to pay for the office. So despite the charges of being of out-of-state money by Scott Walker, this was all done by the people of the North Shore. So I think that kind of gives you a little idea about how the operation runs, Sarah.
How are you going to take the momentum that was used in the grassroots, the stuff that John Nichols was talking about, and keep it going in your area?
Well, you know, that's what we've been all about all along, which is the idea that politics is a life, or as we like to say from time to time, it's a lifestyle. And so we've been keeping people involved in the political process. I mean, that was the purpose of this organization, was that, as John pointed out in his interview, a lot of times people would do an election, you get somebody in office, and then everyone goes dormant between elections. That has hurt us severely, because the other side, they keep on going. They're rabidly involved in politics, and of course, when you make things up in your mind about how awful the Democrats are, or you believe in the rapture and that your ticket to heaven is punched by being a Republican, of course you pretty much stay with it. So we needed to find a way to keep people involved, and so we did it with the continual internet connection and with the ongoing meetings. And so what's gonna have to happen is two things. First of all, I think we really have to be proud of what we did. One of the things that one of the challenges we have as progressives is that we have been beat down so many times that there's a certain pessimism among us. But I think this is, if we come away with anything from what happened on Tuesday, and by the way, I'm sorry I didn't bump into you, but you know, of course, there are so many of us there for the drop off of the GAB. But I think one of the things that we learned from Tuesday was to look at what we did. This gathering of the 1 million signatures is by no means no small accomplishment. And so we have to keep congratulating each other about this, so that we realize that we are capable of really great things. And then the second thing is also, as John pointed out, is we have to keep at this. And one of the ways that we're looking to do this is we are interested in helping other parts of the state form chapters just like Grassroots North Shore. And there are, you know, there are other grassroots groups, fortunately, that have popped up around the state of Wisconsin. We have the Grassroots Network under Nate Timm, who I think you've talked to from time to time. We have Middle Wisconsin. We have Grassroots of Southwestern Wisconsin. That's Shirley Barnes's group. And even here in Milwaukee, we've had some offshoots, or what I call franchises of Grassroots North Shore. Dale Nook has helped organize Grassroots South Shore, which is the Cudahy, South Milwaukee, that part of town. And then we have a Grassroots Tulsa. And I'm sure soon we're going to have a Grassroots of Milwaukee. So again, it gets back to John's point that we have to keep people involved and interested. And as Dave Obey pointed out this week, you know, this next step is not going to be easy. You know, no doubt about it, because Scott Walker is out there and he's looking to get money. And this is. We're going to be the center of the political universe, and I don't think I'm exaggerating here. We've got people outside of the state of Wisconsin who've got a lot invested, and we'll be investing a lot in making sure that we aren't successful. So, let's not kid ourselves. Of course, this is going to take a lot of money, but if we put the type of energy into the election as we did with gathering the signatures, I think we stand a very good chance of taking over the gubernatorial chair in the West Wing of the state capitol. But also, you know, we have the organizations in place, and we can keep on going, and we can do what we need to do to hold the seat and also to take back the assembly and to take back Wisconsin values.
Well, what you're talking about organizing and different groups you're organizing, are you organizing anyone in Waukesha or the areas around New Berlin, Franklin, Brookfield, Elmbrook, maybe some of the even more redder areas? Like, I don't know what's harder to be redder than Waukesha, but Walworth County's not real blue by any stretch of imagination. So are you looking into, I know you're reaching out, but is anyone actively working in those areas?
Well, at this point, we're going to be, we are, in fact, there's a meeting that's going to be taking place Sunday that I'm going to be hopefully going to out in Waukesha. Now, as you know, there's a structure called OFA, which will become Obama for America for the election, and they've had a lot of people involved with that out in Waukesha. But the thing with OFA is once the president's elected, that organization is going to be pretty much going away. So we're hoping to talk to those people about transforming their organization from being an arm of the national Obama organization to becoming an ongoing grassroots type operation. So we'll be looking to talk to them. We have worked with the group that's in the 28th Senate District, which includes New Berlin, and so, like I said, we're along with running our own organization, we have our eyes open for the opportunity to, let's say, impart the model of what we're doing here in the North Shore. I mean, I want to point something out too, Sarah. That's important to note. Unions have of course been the bedrock of Democratic and progressive politics. And I think one of the things that has to be put across is because the unions are what support what we're trying to do, attacking the unions are attacking the middle class, because even though most of us in the middle class don't belong to unions, that's the, let's say, the monetary support that we have right now. So what we have to do is we have to come up with organizations that fill in the void that's left by the unions. You have the fact that the unions have been fighting for their own life, but there's large portions of Wisconsin where there aren't a lot of people that belong to unions, such as the North Shore, for example. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to put that structure in place in order to have people active and involved, and also, of course, to raise money to help support the effort. So, my feeling is if anyone out in these other areas are interested in forming such a group, they can certainly feel free to get in touch with me, and we'd be very willing and able to talk to them about how to do it.
Well, you talked a little bit about using social media, and I know that you said Howard Dean was the first one to do it. Are you using any social media to get some of this messaging out?
Quite a bit. We have a weekly newsletter that we send out to our membership, and actually it's kind of funny because Scott Walker has been good for business. We had, starting off back in January before all the ruckus began, we had 650 people on our emailing list around the North Shore. And now we're standing at a total of 1,050 people who are members of Grassroots North Shore. So the newsletter has been an important tool for us, and people have come to realize that if they have some sort of a progressive related event, that they get the information to us, so we become kind of like a bulletin board. But we also make a lot of use of Twitter and Facebook, and Facebook is a great organizing tool. You can, we've used it quite a bit to set up meetings and to invite people. But also we've used things such as Evites, you know, when we have events, and we've also done robocalls. And it's funny because when we first proposed the idea of robocalls, there were some members of our steering committee who objected to it because of the fear of people being turned off, but it turns out that, that the robocalls have been a great tool for attracting people to our meetings. And actually, the service that we use is, if somebody's interested in forming a group, the service that we use is fairly reasonable, fairly easy to use, and if you have someone with a fairly decent voice, quite effective.
We're going to take a quick break right now, but after the break, we will be back with Keith Schmidt to discuss grassroots organizing and try to get more into the media aspect of it. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Hello, I'm Representative Sandy Pope Roberts with this week's Democratic Address. Over the course of the past year, Governor Walker and the Republican-controlled legislature conducted an all-out assault on Wisconsin's cherished public schools. Last summer, the governor signed a state budget that reduced funding for public education by $1.6 billion. While our public schools were forced to manage these devastating cuts, the governor increased funding to unaccountable and unproven voucher schools by $40 million and approved $2.3 billion in giveaways to large corporations and special interests. Districts all over the state have already begun to feel the pain of these cuts through the larger class sizes, staff reductions, and a loss of experienced educators due to massive retirements. Nearly 97% of districts are seeing reductions in state aid this year. And a recent nonpartisan national report shows Wisconsin is second in the country in education cuts. However, the worst may be yet to come. Districts from Black River Falls to Superior to Oshkosh are giving their communities an early forecast of major shortfalls for next school year and seeking input on how the cuts should be managed. With the one-time fixes already used up, school boards are now forced to make the types of decisions that divide communities and families. This includes property tax increases, additional teacher reductions, cutting educational programming, increasing class sizes, and shutting down entire schools. Here are some notable examples of how Governor Walker's extreme agenda will affect school districts across Wisconsin. Merrill is facing a $1.4 million shortfall, is considering increased class sizes, further cuts to teachers' take-home pay, and there may have to close two elementary schools. Lodi is projecting a $1.6 million deficit. They, too, may be closing a school and are considering moving to a four-day week, cutting co-curricular programs, and firing up to 20 staff members. La Crosse avoided layoffs this year thanks to federal stimulus funds, but next year they face a $2.8 million shortfall and a likelihood of having to raise property taxes. While Governor Walker and his Republican allies pushed brutal cuts and created these shortfalls, the Assembly Democrats put forth a bold plan for Wisconsin. The Save Our Schools initiative would have provided $376 million for public schools and tech colleges while lowering property taxes statewide. It also would have provided more than 85% of state districts with higher funding than under Governor Walker's plan. No district would have received less. My colleagues and I will be reintroducing this plan as a standalone bill next month. We will not stand on the sidelines while our schools are decimated by draconian cuts. Our schools are the foundation of our economic future. The direction that Governor Walker has taken Wisconsin is putting our children's future prospects and our state's economic viability in jeopardy. As school districts around our state plan their budgets for next school year and the bleak projections become a reality, one thing grows increasingly clear. Governor Walker's reforms are not working.
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show. We are talking to Keith Schmidt from Grassroots North Shore. And I wanted to get a little bit into progressive. We were talking a little bit about the media. Now let's talk about progressive radio and newspapers. There are some progressive newspapers that get out to some of the other parts of the state, some in Milwaukee. But progressive radio, there's very little of it. It doesn't go very far. And what you usually hear is opinions, I call them op-eds, from Charlie Sykes, Vicki McKenna, you know, the group. How do you plan on getting more of a voice in progressive radio out to the rest of the state?
Well, you know, there's a number of ways to do that, a number of ways to skin this cat, and we always look for the easiest way to skin the cat. And so a group of us have been at this for longer than I can remember, and what we originally thought we could do is raise some money to buy a radio station, but that turned out to be kind of a heavy lift because you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not $1 million, to get on the radio. So we've come up with a different idea. I want to just backtrack a little bit about the importance, Sarah, of having a radio station. When you look at it, what we've had going on in the state here with the Walker takeover and the GOP takeover of the state government was quite a bit propelled by talk radio in Milwaukee. You know, we've got two major talk radio hosts here, Charlie Sykes and Mark Belling. Now, Mark Belling, I think basically what he does is he just gets people stirred up, and he just sort of he's what H.L. Mencken would call a mob master, which he just appeals to the worst interests, worst instincts of the people in Milwaukee, and they feel they need that. But Charlie's a little bit different. Charlie is really a tool of the Republican Party because what he does is intimately involved with the strategy of the Republicans. In fact, Charlie represents in-kind donation from the Journal Company, the Republican Party, of perhaps millions of dollars. And so he's largely been responsible for getting people elected in the Milwaukee area and for shoving a lot of votes in Scott Walker's direction. Certainly putting him in the spot that he is today because he was a major force in getting Walker elected as county executive. And that's what launched his career because Walker is always looking at the next office ahead than the one that he's in now. And that probably explains why he does such a bad job in every office that he occupies. So the thing of it is radio, even Charlie Sykes' station only represents about maybe 8 or 9% of the listenership in the Milwaukee metropolitan area at any one time. Nevertheless, because he's on the air, the things that he talks about gets out into the Milwaukee public discourse. And let's face it, Charlie has done a great job of polluting that discourse. So a radio station, we've concluded, is very important to having things get out there for discussion. So what we're looking to do is we know that there's probably a bottom there's talk radio stations or there's radio stations that rank very low in the market, and we tried this before. There was a smooth jazz radio station that was on, and people concluded that the only time they listened to smooth jazz was when they were sitting in a dental chair. That format went out, and we knew it was going out, so we tried to get the programming. We tried to get to the programming director to suggest progressive radio, but we never were able to get to them, and then they made the switch over to, I think it was country and western. So really the thing of it is, it's not so much the listeners that drive programming decisions, because let's face it, Milwaukee is a very democratic area, and by all rights, we should have a progressive radio station. As a matter of fact, my mother, who lives down in Destin, Florida, which is in Ogallala County, which is very Republican, almost as Republican as Waukesha, they have a progressive radio station in Destin, Florida. So why can't we have one? Well, here's the problem. Programming directors are by nature very timid people, and they will not make a change or what they would consider to be a radical change. They want to make sure that if they put something on, they want something that they think will work. So that's why they go for sports programming or rock or country or whatever, because the progressive radio format's never been tried in Milwaukee. So here's what we're proposing to do, Sarah. We are looking to round up local advertisers because we know that there's a number of types of businesses that tend to support progressive radio. So if you listen to the mic in Madison or you listen to the Chicago's progressive talk, there are certain types of businesses that will advertise on progressive radio, such as trial attorneys and restaurants and chiropractors and businesses like that. So what we're going to do is we are looking to get 20 to 30 businesses to commit to supporting the progressive format. And then we're going to find those stations which are at the bottom of the barrel in terms of rankings, and we're going to approach the programming directors at these stations and say, hey, have you thought about progressive radio? And, oh, by the way, we have also done your job for you, and we have people lined up to advertise. So, therefore, you have no excuse not to do this. So, that, in a nutshell, is basically the way we look to approach this, Sarah.
Well, on top of that, does Grassroots North Shore advocate for or suggest boycotting businesses that have supported Walker and the Republicans, as well as boycotting WTMJ, WISN, or other Milwaukee news outlets?
You know, it's funny. We have an open architecture type format with Grassroots North Shore. So if someone is suggesting a boycott, they can put something up on our website and we'll put it on the newsletter. But as an organization, we haven't really gone into the boycott idea. As a matter of fact, we have a food store here in Shorewood, and the owners of the store were going to show up at a fundraiser that was going to be held for Alberta Darling here in Shorewood, believe it or not, because as I don't know if many of you listeners know this, but Shorewood is kind of like a mini Madison. We jokingly refer to ourselves as the People's Republic of Shorewood. But, yes, we do have some Republicans here in Shorewood, and, of course, I think they feel like they're under siege, so they're a little more strident than others. But wait a second. No, they're all strident. But anyhow, so the owners of the store were going to show up at the fundraiser, and there was a suggestion that we should boycott their store. I was against that because my feeling was, with all the public employees that we have working here in Shorewood, particularly with UWM, Walker's policies with having the give backs, you know, on the pensions and on the benefits, I felt was going to be an economic blow to the area. And so my feeling was I didn't want to dilute the impact of what Walker did to the owners of that food store. I didn't want them to be able to blame us for it, if you know what I mean. And I think in a way we're seeing that now statewide, because ironically, you know, we were seeing job growth, and I hope I'm not getting off track too much here, but, you know, we were seeing job growth going on in the first 6 months of 2011 after Walker had taken office. And let's face it, most of those jobs that were created, the thought to create the jobs took place under when Doyle was governor. And so when Walker put his program in place, when the assembly, the state legislature passed the program, guess what? We started losing jobs. So I guess it's kind of a roundabout way of answering your question, but that's kind of the way we've rolled in terms of boycotts.
So basically, boycotting is a double-edged sword, in your opinion.
You have to if you want to use that sword, you got to make sure that it's not blunted. And in some ways, there's other swords that are being used. And I felt that let's just stand back and really let people know what's going on with Walker's policies. I mean, let's face it, you know, we're going into this recall, and of course none of us, you know, want to see the state do bad. You know, we want the economy to be successful, of course, because, you know, that's just the way we are. But, you know, we're just being predicting here, not wishing this to happen. But there's no reason to believe that the policies that Walker has put into place are going to help this economy. And so as we go into this recall, I mean, you look at what happened during Watergate. Watergate, actually, when the scandal broke, was getting no traction. But as the economy started getting worse and worse during the Nixon administration, that's really what brought Nixon down. And so what's going to happen in the state is that as we move along, and even though that the national economy is really picking up, because of the policies that Walker's put into place, I don't think he's going to help the economy. And that's really going to be the big issue, I think, that's going to eventually knock Walker out of office when we get around to the recall elections in summer.
If people are if people want more information, I knew I'd get it out eventually,
yeah,
about about North Shore grassroots, North Shore grassroots. You know,
grassroots North Shore.
I'm done. That's it.
Should I take over for the?
Yeah, can you please?
Can
you please?
Sure.
I'd be great. If people want more information about your group, where can they go?
Go to our website, which is grassrootsnorthshore.org. And we have a tab for signing up, or you can get in touch directly with me. And my email address is schmitz1, that's S-C-H-M-I-T-Z, and that's the number 1, at ameritech.net. And would love to hear from people from all over the state, because we want to spread this little virus known as grassroots politics, because as John Nichols pointed out, ultimately, this is what's going to save us. And I think ultimately, too, that this is the thing that's going to knock out Citizens United. I think the best way to do it is by people being active, not just by passing some law or by the Supreme Court knocking it off, but by people actually getting out there and getting involved.
Hey, can you repeat that email again for everyone?
Sure. It's schmitz1 at ameritech.net, and Schmitz is spelled S-C-H-M-I-T-Z. Or Z, and the number 1.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being on the Sarah Schultz Show today. It was a wonderful conversation. We'll have to have you back to talk a little bit more about how this is moving forward and more about grassroots organizing.
It was fast and fun, and I look forward to the next time, Sarah.
Great. Thanks. Have a great day.
Yeah, have a good weekend.
Thank you. You
Bye-bye.
Too. Bye. That was Keith Schmidt with Grassroots North Shore. Coming up next is Yuri right after this break.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. January 17th was a great day for Wisconsin and a great day for labor rights and democracy across the country. It was the day that organizers of the drive to recall Governor Scott Walker delivered more than 1 million signatures, almost twice the number needed. It was, per capita, the biggest recall ever in the history of the United States. And it was a grassroots effort through and through, with 30,000 people volunteering or circulating petitions over the last 60 days. 30,000 people. Scott Walker brought this on himself. His sneak attack on labor unions and his all-out assault on the public good in Wisconsin on behalf of his corporate paymasters didn't succeed. Instead, it awoke a latent solidarity and class consciousness, the likes of which I've never seen in this country. Not for nothing that people joke that Scott Walker should get the award for Union Organizer of the Year. Now he's in a world of hurt. He got only about 1,129,000 votes last time around, and almost that exact number has already signed the petitions for his ouster. It seems likely that Wisconsin voters will soon put his bags on the curb. And when that day comes, democracy, real grassroots democracy, will have prevailed. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We are now talking with Yuri Rashkin with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. Good morning, Yuri. How are you doing today?
Good morning, Sarah. I'm doing very well. And yourself?
It is a wonderful day. It's been a wonderful week, actually. Tuesday was just amazing. So,
you know, I've been kind of following it via Facebook and Internet, and it seems like it was just an incredible celebration up at the Capitol and then Monona Terrace and everything, and it's really great what's happening in the state. I think the people did what we were supposed to do. We got the signatures.
Got a lot of the signatures. A lot of the signatures. 1.9 million plus all four senators recalled. I mean, this was an amazing recall effort. Not only did we get the governor recalled, which has happened twice before, we had the lieutenant governor recalled and four senators recalled, in part thanks to Lori Compass. So, I mean.
Exactly. And so, not surprisingly, our number one story this week really is recall and the fact that all the signatures were gathered that you mentioned, and for Fitzgerald recall, 4,000 signatures more than necessary were gathered, and this is a senator that was considered to be in a safe seat. And in fact, four Republicans, we have Scott Fitzgerald of Juneau, Pam Galloway of Wausau, and Terry Moulton of Chippewa Falls, and Van Wongard of Racine. All of those have qualified or gathered signatures have been gathered for recall. Now, all of these senators also have money on hand to fight these recalls, total of about $734,000, and only one of them, Pam Galloway, currently has somebody who said this person is going to run against her, and that's Jeff Johnson, who's taken a leave as chair of Marathon County Democratic Party. None of the other soon-to-be-recalled senators have anybody running against them. However, there is a move, a grassroots move, to make Lori Compass the candidate against Scott Fitzgerald. We'll see what happens.
Well, and Mike Tate said that, too, at the party afterwards, the kind of, I don't even know what to call it, it was a party. It was amazing. But he basically called her on stage and said, I think we have our next candidate for senator here. And she keeps saying no, but there's so much push behind it. And she's already confronted him at some of his listening sessions. So I hope that really gains ground, and I hope she actually runs. I think that would be really exciting.
That would be. And, you know, there's an example of social media generating buzz and people working in real and virtual world together and getting some real results. This is awesome. Now, in the meantime, Scott Walker is busy not governing, but flying all over the nation and fundraising. And everywhere he goes, he's greeted by protesters, whether it's in Austin, Texas, or New York City. That's really exciting because everybody knows what he's about. And now he is busy pushing for early recalls, which on some level makes sense because now, you know, the same way that Republicans were stalling recalls last summer, now they want to go through them as soon as possible, basically trying to deprive their opposition, people of Wisconsin, of opportunity to find appropriate candidates and create brand awareness for those candidates and help those candidates raise money. So now Scott Walker is pushing for early recall, and you can count that whatever he's thinking, whatever he's saying is either not true or hurtful to the people of Wisconsin.
And beneficial to Scott Walker.
Exactly. So that brings up the question of running on the Democratic side. I ran a little poll at Defend Wisconsin News Roundup just to see what the grassroots activists are thinking, and I was quite surprised because by some of the information that I've been reading through media, Tom Barrett supposedly is doing quite well. Well, in the poll that we put out, it really is all about John Erkenbach, who is out front by about 3-1 margin. The next tier down is Russ Feingold, Dave Obey, and Peter Barca, even though in the very question I said, let's presume Russ Feingold is not running, and still Feingold, Obey, and Barca are in tier two with about a third of the votes that John Erkenbach has generated. And Kathleen Vinehout, Doug LaFollette, and Ron Kind are kind of this tier three. And Kathleen Falk and Tom Barrett are barely registering on the radar at all.
And that's what I'm hearing, too. And there's two grassroots movements, one to get Peter Barca as governor, one to get Russ Feingold as governor. And the Russ Feingold for governor grassroots movement is really starting to take off. Now, did you get Herb Kohl on there at all?
I'm trying to think. Yes, somebody. In fact, one of the wonderful things about these polls is that people can add options, and so Herb Kohl was on the, there, and I think he got roughly the same number of votes as Tom Barrett, which is about two. So can't really, you know, I think if this was a real poll, it would be called in a margin of error, 0 ± 2%. So really, I think, and John Erkenbach in one of the stories that we cited on our website this week said that he was not running in the recall. So that means that out of potentially existing candidates who have not declined to be running, Dave Obey and Peter Barca are really the top tier. And Dave Obey just came out with a statement warning that Democrats who think that almost any person nominated to run against Scott Walker can win are dead wrong. This is a steep uphill fight. If we do win, it will be by a razor-thin margin, which, you know, can be read in many different ways, including that we need a strong candidate. And obviously, Dave Obey would be a very strong candidate. So perhaps this is indicating, signaling some interest that he has in running, which would be great.
Well, and Erpenbach and Barker, you said they were in Tier 2 or Tier 1?
Erpenbach is by far the most popular. I think he has 3-1 lead on everybody else. And Barker is Tier 2 with Obey and Feingold.
Okay. You know, it's interesting. The establishment, the party seems to be backing the people that everyone who really pushed this recall doesn't want.
Yes.
The question is there actually a strategy behind it other than just people coming out and saying we're going to run? Because Colin is also running. By the way, where did Colin fall on this?
I think he got about 4 votes in our poll.
Okay.
And this is, we had about, I think, 400 votes total so far. So, like, for instance, John Erpenbach had 130 or 140 votes versus Tom Barrett, who had 2.
Definitely difference there.
You can see where there's a real difference. And there's a real, you know, there's always desire on part of organized structures to try to control the grassroots movement and try to ride this wave in some kind of direction. But the same way that the recalls happen sooner than party leaders may have wanted them to occur, it seems like those candidates that are trying to get that top tier leadership structures support are not really getting it from the grassroots. And that's really why we need to have a primary. I think that's really the key here, is the main point of all of this. We need to have a primary. Now, we have a kind of a funny story just to kind of take your mind off of this serious stuff.
Scott Walker, you have about a minute, so.
Perfect. So, well, okay. So WMC, as you know, paid for these billboards saying, call Scott Walker and tell him thank you for creating all of these jobs. Billboards featuring smiling Scott Walker. There's one
of
these billboards.
The WMC is the Wisconsin
Manufacturers and Commerce,
okay.
And kind of Chamber of Commerce. And they put a billboard saying, call Scott Walker and thank him, right in front of the Janesville GM plant that's been closed for 3 years. So it's hilarious. So I went out there and shot video of it, wrote a little blog entry, put it on the web. It's been now cited by Daily Kos, One Cat, and Huffington Post. The blog has been seen by over 8,000 people in the first 48 hours I put it up, and the video has been viewed by about 3,000 people. Hopefully this would be a colorful metaphor and an epitaph for Scott Walker's short reign in Wisconsin.
Yeah, no jobs. That would be...
No jobs.
No
jobs. Thanks for nothing.
Yeah. No, it's not working, Scott Walker. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Ahead.
You're welcome, Sarah.
I just want to say
that in December we lost 3,900 jobs, but, boy, just far for the course with Scott Walker.
That's one more month of job loss. Will you hang on for a second here? I want to get you at the break, so hold on a second. But
all right.
I'd like to thank Yuri Raskin for being on. He's with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. And after this next break coming up, we're going to have the recorded interview with Chris Liebenthal about the John Doe investigation. So listen to the Sarah Schultz Show.
So there you sit in your cushy chair, just keep on doing all the talking.
Woo-hoo. Woo-hoo.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Being wrong. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop,
Welcome back. The second hour of the Sarah Schultz Show starts with a recorded interview I did with Chris Liebenthal about the John Doe investigation. Now, the John Doe investigation has been going on since 2010, and we've pretty much tried to set up a timeline of what's going on. So here he is.
I am speaking with Chris Liebenthal, who is the writer of the blog Cognitive Dissonance. Welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show today, Chris.
Well, thank you for having me out.
Well, you're welcome. You have been following the John Doe investigation, which you call Walkergate, for quite a while now, and you are probably the person who knows the most about it, one of the people who know the most about it. So can you tell a little bit about the updates? They happened about a week or so ago with Russell and the arrest, but can you go a little bit, you don't have to go into a lot of detail, but go a little bit into detail about it and then connect that back to the John Doe as Walkergate, as you perceive Walkergate to be?
Well, on January 4th, actually January 5th, the Thursday, the Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm held a press conference, and he announced that there were three arrests stemming from the Walkergate investigation. One of them was Tim Russell, who is probably the biggest name and is central to the whole John Doe investigation. The other two were a gentleman named Kevin Kavanaugh and Brian Peerick. The arrests of Kavanaugh and Russell stemmed from embezzlement charges where they were stealing money from an organization called Operation Freedom, which was an annual event that Walker used to hold as Milwaukee County Executive. It was to honor the veterans and their families by allowing them to have a free day at the Milwaukee County Zoo. It turned out from the investigation that the two gentlemen stole about $60,000 from this fund over several years that it was in operation. However, it's pretty apparent that these arrests were more of a tangent from the John Doe investigation that's been going on. They had done a raid of Russell's house back in August of 2010, where they took the computers, smartphones, and everything from the home, whether it belonged to Russell or his partner, Brian Peerick. And that's where they found this information about the embezzlement and also about the arrest of Peerick is totally unrelated to the investigation. It would be similar to the police stopping somebody for speeding and then finding out that they had, drugs in the car. It was just a coincidental find that led to the charges against Peerick. Likewise, the charges against Russell and Kavanaugh, I believe, are also a bonus find, if you will, that they came across this while they were investigating other matters, including politicking during government, while Russell was acting as a government official, which is, of course, illegal.
Who is the target on the John Doe, and are these people just being found out as they're going through around the target then?
Russell isn't necessarily John Doe himself. How he got involved was that in May of 2010, Scott Walker took his Harley-Davidson bike ride around the state. Now, this bike ride was done on the pretense that Walker was supposedly promoting tourism from Milwaukee County. It was pretty obvious that it was nothing more than a campaign stunt, though. He normally would hold this bike ride at the end of June every year, but for some reason in 2010 he decided to move it up to May, the middle of May, claiming that it was too warm at the end of June for people to go riding a motorcycle around the state. I believe if you ride a bike around, and you know that summer is the time that people that ride motorcycles really want to go out and do it. The warmer, the better the ride.
it's a beautiful time. June, end of June, early July. That's an absolutely gorgeous time to be on the motorcycle and ride around.
The other thing that gave it away, too, that it was an obvious political stunt, was that it just so happened, quote-unquote, coincidentally, to end back in Milwaukee just as the Republican State Convention was occurring in Milwaukee, where Walker was expected to gain the nomination for governor. You know, so it was a pretty obvious political stunt to help promote his campaign rather than to promote anything about Milwaukee County.
Did he, while he was driving around on the bike, did he actually promote anything for Milwaukee County, or was he just promoting himself?
It was pretty much just promoting himself. He would try to tout some things about Milwaukee County, such as an award that Milwaukee County Parks won based on a video that he had professionally produced. Also trying to tout his budgetary record, which I don't understand how that has anything to do with tourism. But, you know, these were the things he was trying to promote. While he was doing this bike ride, Tim Russell was accompanying him as a county official. The weird thing about that is Russell at that time was director of housing, which, of course, has nothing to do with tourism. You know, that's a program to help subsidize housing. They deal with federal HUD grants and that sort of thing. Russell was there as an employee, yet the Democrats who have followed Walker on this bike ride have videotapes of Russell performing what could be perceived as campaign things, unfurling air flags and other paraphernalia like that, organizing photo ops with local politicians. And there's a video that the Democrats had just released showing Russell organizing a photo op with Scott Walker and Representative Luther Olson.
That was convenient. How is Luther Olson going to help with the tourism in Milwaukee County?
And, well, considering the photo op only consisted of maybe five or six people, most of which were, you know, Walker and Olson was two of them. The others were people that either were, you know, with Olson's group or was riding along with Walker. So, you know, I didn't see any promotion of Milwaukee County in their whole thing. Ironically, you can hear the cameraman who is off out of the picture of the video getting ready to take the picture in, and he jokes around saying, "Say Republican," and you can see Walker grimace as he corrects him and saying, "No, say tourism," and everybody has a big laugh about it. So, you know, it was pretty obvious that, you know, this was just a joke to Walker that it had anything to do with tourism.
And this is the start? This is what brought about the John Doe investigation then?
Well, this held trigger at the Democrats filed a complaint with the GAB, the Government Accountability Board, who then said, no, this isn't the correct forum. You need to refer it back to the Milwaukee County DA. The DA had also been contacted by local officials here in Milwaukee, complaining about the actions of Darlene Wink and asking for an investigation into the activities of Walker's office, because there was just so many red flags popping up. And, you know, that's when shortly after that complaint was filed, the DA ordered the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office to do basically a raid on Tim Russell's county office, where they took two computers and also his smartphone. They pried open file cabinets and were witnessed to have taken out boxes of papers.
And when was this that they raided Russell's house?
So it was shortly after they did his office. So it was, you know, mid to later in 2010.
August, September, something in that range?
I believe so.
And this is in the middle of the gubernatorial campaign, and yet none of this got out.
Well, that's part of the nature of Chando investigations are that they are secretive.
Right, but... The John Doe, I understand that the John Doe is secretive, but it's the fact that this investigation didn't get out from in the rest of the state. No one said, hey, there's this John Doe investigation going on here, and it has to revolve around some of the things around Walker's cabinet.
Well, I do know that Dan Weiss from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel did report that they did go after Russell's office. Nowhere was it reported that they did a search of his house as well. And, you know, but there was just that one article saying that they took, you know, they went into Russell's county office and removed the computer. We have learned later that they also took the phone and went into the file cabinets. But otherwise, you know, no, I don't recall seeing anything outside of that one article from Mr. Bison in the paper. And it just never played outside of Milwaukee County.
So I guess the next phase of this was when they raided Cindy Archer's house then.
Well, there would be, you know, they raided Cindy Archer's home in Madison in September of 2011. And I just looked at my notes. They did Russell's home in December of 2010. So in that 9 months, there was only a few things that would come up, like the fact that many of the people that were being found to be persons of interest had really lawyered up with some of the biggest names in the state. You know, attorneys like Steve Piskulik, who was hired by Walker's campaign, to represent that at $60,000. And just to start out with, I'm sure that the fee's gone much higher by now. Russell had hired attorney Michael Maselman, who is one of the leading political attorneys in the state of Wisconsin. I've heard names like Frank Gimbel pop up and, you know, other well-known attorneys. But otherwise, it wasn't a lot of information until, like you said, September of 11 when they went into to a search of Cindy Archer's home. There the FBI and Dane County sheriffs executed the search and were seen removing boxes of items. They also took out a hard drive from a computer that Archer had sold to a neighbor a few weeks before that. Now, what is significant about all of that is another story that hasn't never made it statewide, and as far as being reported, was that shortly after Scott Walker left Milwaukee County to assume his role as governor, the acting county executive found that all of Walker's computers and files were missing. You know, all the computers that were assigned to Walker's office, which are normally archived and, you know, the information downloaded for future reference, you know, in case people wanted to do open records requests or, you know, do research on contracts or anything else, all of it was empty. And there was a story in the paper again about that. It showed a picture of a county official standing by all these empty file cabinets with the drawers open. That, to my knowledge, nobody's ever said if they found them.
How does something like that just kind of walk off on its own? Are some of these searches for this? I mean,
That would be my belief, you know, that, you know, the reason they took that hard drive from Cindy Archer's computer was that it could have been a Milwaukee County computer that she took with her. You know, but these things just don't disappear. When Walker was chief of county executive, his chief of staff was Tom Nardelli. They did manage to get a hold of Nardelli, and he gave some wild answer that, we tried to offer to him, to the next county executive. They didn't respond, so we just took it upon ourselves to destroy all the duplicative information. but nobody knows how much information was destroyed. But if it was indeed destroyed, or if it was just removed and taken elsewhere, you know, but it does raise a lot of questions on where this stuff went. And then you have stories like, you know, Tim Russell's house being searched, Cindy Archer's home being searched, other former county officials having their stuff being searched and being brought in for questioning. You know, it makes you wonder if there is a correlation. I don't think it would be a great leap of logic to make that assumption.
With the computers, don't they have serial numbers written down, that they have them labeled somewhere that, you know, this is computer 1, computer 2, however they do it? And aren't they saying, well, we're missing computer 5 through computer 9? I mean, do they know how many computers are even missing?
That was not recorded. There was no specific information as like how many computers were actually missing, how many were accounted for. One of the problems that we had in Milwaukee County was the fact that due to severe understaffing, a lot of the record keeping fell to the wayside. So when there is things like this that come up, or some of the other reports that, you know, were more germane to just Milwaukee County, the information that even the officials could access was woefully inadequate and out of date, because there was just no staff around to keep that information up.
We're speaking with Chris Liebenthal, who is the writer of the blog Cognitive Dissidence, and we're talking about the John Doe investigation, or what he calls Walkergate. Once these computers were found missing, when was that? When did that occur?
And that was back in January of 2011. And right after, you know, shortly after Walker vacated his position as county executive, he left it at the end of December, and the chairman of the Milwaukee County Board, Lee Holloway, assumed the duties and responsibilities as acting county executive for the interim until another one could be appointed, until there was an election. It was at that time that they found that these computers were missing and that these files were missing, but there was never any follow-up report, like I said, about if these were ever located or if, you know, they were already taken by the DA as part of the investigation. All we know from the records, from the local paper, is that they were missing.
And that's the only information anyone has.
Right. You know, and once in a while I would contact the spokesperson for Milwaukee County Board and just ask him if there was any updates about that story. And every time I talked to him, you know, he just said that he hadn't heard anything. He doesn't know if they had been found or not.
January is where the computers went missing. We have the raid. Yeah, the raid in Tim Russell's house in December of 2010. Then you had the raid in Cindy Archer's house in September of 2011. What has happened? You know, and of course we had some things fall in there. We had a couple things that came through. And now what's happened since 2011? We had several arrests in the last couple months with this. It's not Tim Russell.
Well, it wasn't an arrest per se, but there's a Milwaukee area in commercial realty agent, one of the high-powered realty brokers named Andrew Johnson. And he was not arrested, there was no formal charges filed against him, but he was incarcerated in the Milwaukee County Jail for one night and a couple days because he refused to cooperate with the John Doe. It turns out that he wanted to have immunity granted. They had offered him immunity, but part of a John Doe, when a person is given immunity, that part of the hearing, trial, or investigation is made public. Mr. Jensen didn't want his name made public that he was receiving immunity. He he filed an appeal to try to keep his identity secret while still gaining immunity. The appellate court ruled against him, and apparently that's when he decided he was not going to cooperate anymore, so the DA's office had him placed in jail, and they released him late the next afternoon. Likewise, with the immunity deal, it was also came out shortly after the raid on Cindy Archer's home that several key players in Walker's administration or Walker's campaign and, you know, in the Milwaukee area, Republican Party were given immunity based on other, you know, based on parts of the investigation into this John Doe. The most prominent name that was given immunity was Cullen Murray, who was part of Walker's campaign and is currently serving the governor as his spokesperson.
And he's still serving?
Correct. And even after the information came out about the immunity, he continued to serve. Now, it's been recently reported to me that Cullen Murray has decided to stop talking to people that want to ask him questions about the immunity. He just blackballs those reporters, which is, you know, questionable in regards to the ethics, because that would indicate that he's still playing politics while he's in the government position. You know, if he feels uncomfortable addressing that, then maybe he should reconsider his position, in my opinion. Other people that included were given immunity was a woman that was a major part of the Milwaukee County Republican Party. You know, she was a ranking official, and was also very close to Darlene Wing, who, of course, is the first name that came out of all this. You know, that started the whole John Doe type of investigation. The other people that were granted immunity mostly stems from the investigation into William Garner, who was the railroad, or is the railroad, CEO and president of Wisconsin and Southern, who was, of course, arrested and charged and convicted of providing illegal donations to Walker's campaign.
And he just sold the railroad as well to a company in Kansas.
Yeah, a company that is brags about being having their largest customer being the Koch brothers or Koch Industries.
Well, that shouldn't surprise anybody.
No. You know, and several state legislators have already raised a question about this and have asked for the sale to be stopped for at least 60 days while this issue is looked into to make sure that it is a legitimate business deal and not some kind of political payback. Just as a side point of interest to show you how much Walker has a disregard for the law and for ethics. When he made a large deal about the Christmas tree in the state capitol, he had a toy train going around the base of the Christmas tree, which was a replica of a Wisconsin and Southern train with a big sign, you know, thanking them for this model train.
Nice.
Given that Garner was just arrested earlier that year and, you know, convicted and fined for illegal donations, you would think that Walker would at least have the sense of decorum to stay away from that.
You would think, or get another train, maybe get one of the older sets, or get some of the Historical Society to donate something a little more on the up and up.
Yeah, you know, but it's just like he was flaunting the whole deal that was going on. That he had, you know, no remorse, no regrets about getting caught out about this.
Well, we have a couple minutes left, so let's move on now. We had started this discussion talking about the newest arrests, and that are the three, the Tim Russell and the other two.
Right. But But and I know that Walker and his supporters have been trying to paint this as being the culmination of the John Doe investigation, that there was nothing else to see here, just move along. But there's just too many different things that cannot be explained by these arrests that weren't addressed in any of the criminal complaints against any of these three people that were arrested. You know, what role did Colin Worley play? Why was he given immunity? You know, he wasn't part of Walker's executive staff. He wasn't part of Operation Freedom. He, you know, so where does he fit into this? Why was he given immunity? And the arrest have nothing to do with that realty agent, Jensen, who was housed in the county prison for overnight. We do know that he is scheduled to report to the DA's office and meet with them on January 25th. So obviously, the investigation is going on. There's still more that's going to be coming out, I'm sure. Even D.A. Chisholm has said in his press conference that this was an ongoing thing, so there's no reason to believe that this is it. Other questions I had was, Tom Martelli, who served as Walker's county, when Walker was with Milwaukee County, served as his chief of staff, filed them to the state and was given a comfortable position and then was given a promotion after 6 months to an even higher rate, suddenly left his state position without explanation. Another thing that hasn't been explained is why Walker's campaign treasurer, after 18 years, quietly left the campaign. Walker had made a statement at one time that he let the campaign treasurer, Jim Hiller, go because he was getting so much money in that he wanted to make sure that the treasurer was going to be able to keep up with it. Well, after 18 years, all of a sudden he developed a lack of faith in his campaign treasurer. I find that hard to believe. I had mentioned earlier that the Democrats had taken footage of Tim Russell doing what appears to be political campaigning, even though he was along with Walker on this bike ride as a county official. None of this was addressed in the complaint against Russell or the other two gentlemen. So, did the DA find nothing of that, or is this part of the ongoing investigation? And, of course, what we had just talked about, too, the missing computers and files, where were they, what was in them? And why all of a sudden did they disappear?
What's your website that people can go to read up on this?
It's called Cognitive Dissidence. The URL would be cognitiveidence.blogspot.com.
Thank you so much, Chris, for your time. We're speaking with Chris Liebenthal, the writer of the blog Cognitive Dissidence.
And that was about the John Doe investigation. Now, after this break, we will be right back with Lynn Freeman with United Wisconsin to discuss the recall and any stories you may have. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Republicans in Indiana continue efforts to ram through so-called right-to-work legislation that would weaken worker rights to form and sustain unions. The Indiana AFL-CIO's Jeff Harris says despite huge Republican majorities in the legislature, the anti-union legislation may still fail.
There are a number of Republicans in both the House and State Senate who are opposed to the right to work for less, and they have come out publicly as well. So the vote is still incredibly close. I think in the House of Representatives, where there's 100 members and it's a 60-40 partisan split, I think it'll come down to one or two votes. And in the state Senate, where there's 50 votes, 37 of them are Republican and 13 are Democrats, it's also going to be within one or two votes. It's really an economic issue. Who's standing with working men and women and who's standing with corporations?
A poll shows 71% of Hoosiers want to vote a referendum on the issue instead of the legislature deciding it. The NFL Players Association is against the anti-union legislation, and Republicans who back it are trying to get it passed. before the Super Bowl is held in Indianapolis. The NFL Players Association has been more active than usual when it comes to supporting workers in other industries. Jesse Russell reports.
Earlier this month, a group of players challenged the Indiana legislature to not pass right-to-work legislation. And this week, the executive director of the association, DeMarie Smith, sent a strongly worded letter to Cooper Tire, expressing concern with the treatment of workers at a Findlay, Ohio plant, where the workers are locked out. Smith wrote that the association is proud to support the many workers at Cooper Tire who are defying wage-cutting demands, and that he looks forward to the day Cooper Tire meets a standard of living wages, dignity, and respect. The employees have been locked out of the plant since December 13th.
The Labor Network for Sustainability's Joe Uline says the Obama administration's decision to oppose the Keystone XL pipeline project is encouraging. Uline says the proponents of the pipeline are arguing a false choice, that the pipeline project is a choice between jobs or the environment. Uline says labor must come to grips with environmental sustainability, and it's urgent and essential that we begin seriously investing in an environmentally sustainable economy that provides the jobs that we all need. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And that was the chant that we heard walking to the GAB on Tuesday as we went to turn in the petition, the recall petitions. And I'd like to welcome Lynn Freeman to the Sarah Schultz Show. Lynn Freeman is with United Wisconsin. And United Wisconsin obviously is very integral in getting the recall movement, along with all its volunteers and everyone involved with it. So if you were in Madison on Tuesday, you got signatures, you are a coordinator, or you just have a story to share about the recall, we'd love to hear it. So call in at 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. This is such a historic moment. I want everyone to be able to voice what they felt at that time as they were going through it. Good morning, Lynn. How are you?
Good morning, Sarah. I'm well.
Good. Before we start, my producer, Bill, has been really good about doing some reading for me. And he's going to read a blog that I thought was really good at kind of writing down the feelings, especially of this one person, but just the feelings overall of what was going on Tuesday. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Sarah. Hello, everyone. So, yes, I'll be reading a blog entitled So I Carried a Box by Jeff Tully. Jeff posted this Wednesday, January 18th, 2012. A cardboard box, not an especially big box, not the heaviest I've carried by any means, but it had quite a few pieces of paper inside, judging by its heft. You may well have one matching this description in a corner somewhere. To be allowed to carry this box was an amazing honor. This box was packed with the dreams of a million Wisconsinites that we should have the opportunity sooner rather than later to put things right with our state. This box was packed with thousands upon thousands of hours of work by volunteers who lost friendships, lost their weekends, lost time with their families, lost the feeling in their toes, lost money that they spent getting around to where they needed, lost their ability to feel secure in their person when expressing their opinion in public. This box was packed with the efforts of those who'd gone out of their way to find a petition to sign, those who cheered up circulators with a simple smile or a wave or a thumbs up, those who gave us cookies or brought hot chocolate, those who spent the time to listen to us and learn why recall is necessary. This box was packed with the wishes of those who, for whatever reason, didn't get a chance to sign but wanted to. This box was packed with the thoughts of those across the country and across the world who have been following what's been going on in Wisconsin and understand what might just be won here. All of that doesn't fit into a box and never could. You can't carry one of them into the government accountability board offices and not feel overwhelmed as these things come bursting out. The universe simply doesn't allow it. I did not collect the most signatures. I did not spend the most time of anyone on the recall. I neither suffered the most nor sacrificed the most. Nonetheless, I had the opportunity to represent those who had put something into it. So I carried a box.
Thanks, Bill, for doing that. I appreciate it. Now, Lynn?
Yes.
I don't want to say sums it up, but really describes a lot of the things that had happened while going and getting signatures and being coordinators. What was your story on this? What, as United Wisconsin, being someone who is so integral in getting the volunteers together to set up, how did the turn-in on Tuesday affect you?
I'm still speechless from it, apparently. I was so wrapped up with some of the details of finalizing the work of the county coordinators and pulling together details for the celebration on Tuesday night and getting people channeled to the weekend when all the work had to be done, that I really didn't think very much about Tuesday ahead of time. And, you know, when you're going, sometimes you don't think about the next day or what's going to be happening, even if it's a really, you know, substantial day. So on Tuesday, when I was taking part in the day, the walk over to the GAB, when I got to carry my box, what occurred to me was, oh, my gosh, it's now. And I just thought to myself, okay, try to remember every second of what's happening right now because you're going to want to. And there may not be another recording of you doing this. So you know, as I made eye contact with all the people in the line and the security line, all the people who were there, I'll call it the gauntlet, cheering us on. I've done several marathons and triathlons, and there are some of them that they're just big crowds at the end of the event cheering for you and yelling your name as you cross the finish line. And that's exactly what it felt like, except even better.
Well, it's amazing what you guys did. It's absolutely amazing. And I'm going to get to a call real fast, but I want to talk a little bit more about the structure after this call. But I want to talk to Joe, who was, hi, Joe. Welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show. Now, were you a coordinator, volunteer, signature collector? How did you help in the process?
I was a Sauk County coordinator. And I was honored to be there and be part of the Madison celebration. And I'd like, you know, if you'd like to express my thanks to everybody. Mostly, it was an awesome experience. You didn't really know what to expect, but like Lynn said, it was like you were finishing a marathon and you finally got to the end. And you have a lot of different emotions. You know, it's hard to describe.
Well, what was the, if you could pick two of the emotions, because it was just kind of a big ball of everything that had gone on the last 60 days and the last almost 9-10 months. If you could pick out the two top, what were the two that you were feeling at that moment?
It was kind of a exhilaration and then a sense, I would say, of like freedom. And the people waving from the windows and taking pictures. And just it was all positive, and we had had so much negative, and it had been such a struggle that I feel like we had crossed a threshold, and it was a new day. That was the big thing.
Has it set in yet how historic that moment was to you?
Not really. I think part of it is, but it's still there. You know, it's... my mom is 82, and she told me 3 weeks ago, she said, Joe, I don't think you can do it. And I said, Mom, I'm going to do it. I don't care what happens. I have to do it. And she said, you're going to be so disappointed if it doesn't work. And I said, it will work. And now we're really satisfied that we did it.
A million signatures strong. It's what you guys did, what everyone did out there, including the coordinators, the volunteers, a lot of time with the coordinators. It couldn't have been done without your help. You were amazing. Thank you so much for calling in and telling the story, Joe. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Glad to meet you, Sarah. Bye.
Good to meet you, too.
Bye-bye.
Now, we have another caller. We're going to wait on Barb for just a moment, but I want to talk about the structure. You guys, in April, started out with a couple people, I guess, sitting around the table going, we need to do this. And here it is in January, what, 30,000 volunteers strong, 1.9 million signatures put in. How did that all come about?
Well, we really started to get together in March already. It was a lot of people marching around that Capitol and thinking to themselves, I think a lot of people thought to themselves, this is great, but we have to take action. And as I've met people throughout the last 11 months, people have said, I'm going to run for office, or I'm going to pay more attention to politics, I'm going to make sure I'm an educated voter, or I'm going to volunteer for a leadership role in as a political activist, and I've never been politically active before. I'm a voter, but I've never been politically active before. So the marches that were happening around the Capitol, as people started to realize that there was just not going to be any compromise and Walker wasn't going to listen, they became activists. They decided they were going to have to take some concrete action, and that is exactly what was going through the minds of the people who ended up becoming some form of leadership within United Wisconsin, and there was a lot of different kind of leadership. And we decided, you know, after a couple of different organizational meetings, there was one in the east side of Madison, there was one in Milwaukee, people just stuck around afterwards and said, okay, let's bring our talents together. Who's got fundraising experience? Who's got some technology skills? And we pretty quickly laid out an organizational chart of what all the things what were the skills and areas that we would need to make this happen. Meanwhile, the Facebook page and the website was blowing up, and people were, by the thousands, were signing the petition online, which, you know, we knew we would have to create an organization to channel that energy. So it's really hard to explain how it happened because, Sarah, it was almost an accident. And it was only because people said, we got to do something about this. The other thing that I want to say, I'm wondering if Jeff and Barb are having this experience too, but a lot of people are thanking me. You know, as a board member and as someone who was with United Wisconsin from the beginning of all this, and I feel it's very hard to accept that thanks gracefully because I don't feel I personally deserve that thanks any more than anyone else does. You can't. All we did was we harnessed the wave of the, you know, the citizens of Wisconsin saying that they wanted something done. We harnessed the wave and we gave them a channel to do something in. But if there hadn't been tens of thousands of volunteers willing to help, if there hadn't been over 1 million people willing to sign, there would have been nothing. So, you know, you can't lead if people aren't willing to follow, and you can't accomplish what was accomplished, not what we accomplished, but what's accomplished by lots of different groups if people don't feel passionately about it. So I don't know if some of the county coordinators and some of the other folks in leadership roles have experienced that, people thanking them. You know, I'm getting Facebook messages and emails, and I'm very grateful for those. But what I want to say to all of them, so I'm going to use your radio program to do it, is to say, wouldn't have happened. I don't deserve any more thanks, and none of the leadership deserves any more thanks than anybody else, because this was truly collective and collaborative.
Well, I'm going to go to Barb now. And Barb, going into what Lynn said, have you had a lot of people thanking you for all the stuff that you've done with the recall?
Well, in spite of being a county coordinator for United Wisconsin, and that's great. I'm really glad they found a place for me to belong, to put some of my efforts in. I didn't really get to do as much as a lot of the other coordinators. So the thanks I receive, I can quite easily turn around to the people who are thanking me. I didn't actually get to be in Madison on Tuesday when they were delivering the boxes. Back in April, I lost my job because Governor Walker had his budget repair bill, and in that bill they put caps on MCOs, managed care organizations. Because of those caps, my company had to make a lot of cuts, and I lost my job. And to this day, I'm still looking for a job. And so financially, I couldn't go. And I have no health insurance, so physically, I get scared even leaving the house. But I watched it on a live feed, and I have to tell you, as the people marched down the street with their signs and chanting, I was sitting here in my room crying. And then when I watched each box taken out of that truck, I can't tell you. It felt like each box that came out took a weight off my heart because it's been such a long trip for me. Being laid off without a job is difficult, but the economic circumstances we live in Wisconsin have made it so much worse than it could have been. And those people who took those boxes off the truck, they just meant the world to me.
Now, I'm going to take a quick break because I want people to think about that, what Barb just said. And we'll be right back. Barb, hang on with us. We'll be right back with Lynn Freeman from United Wisconsin and Barb, one of the county coordinators. And you're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Hi, this is Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse. You can find us on iTunes. This past Tuesday, United Wisconsin and the Democratic Party of Wisconsin submitted 1 million signatures to recall Governor Scott Walker, nearly double the amount of signatures that were actually needed, far, far exceeding the required 540,208 signatures. In fact, there were 6 recall petitions that were circulating for the past 2 months, and all 6 of them, all against Republicans, were widely successful. Rebecca Clayfish received 845,000 signatures to recall her, which was, again, far exceeding the 540,208 needed signatures. What is truly amazing is not that Wisconsin is standing up against Scott Walker and Rebecca Clayfish, but one Lori Compass out of Fort Atkinson. All by herself, Lori Compass decided to try and recall Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. The Democratic Party did not help Ms. Compass's efforts until the very last week. Ms. Compass had 2 months to collect 16,742 signatures. When it was all said and done, she turned in 20,600 signatures, 123% of what was needed. This is what should have the government running scared, especially the Republican Party, when they see that grassroots people can still make a difference. I'm Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse, and it's just something to think about.
We're back with the Sarah Schultz Show. Sarah Schultz, I'm talking with Lynn Freeman from United Wisconsin, and Barb, who's one of the county coordinators. Went to a quick break because I was thinking back on some of the stuff that I had, and Barb, your story just touched me, and I was trying to collect myself so I just wouldn't break down in tears on the show. It reminded me of a funny story that I happened. I was on my way to Indiana, and I have a recall Walker sticker, and I'm down going 70 down 94 in Illinois right now. And I'm driving, all of a sudden, out of the corner of my eye, there's a car that's next to me. And this car is just, it's kind of keeping up with me. And I thought, oh, no, what are we doing now? Jeez, I'm going to get in some kind of race. What's going on? And they started honking their horn at me. And I finally turned to them, and they had their window rolled down, and I'm looking at them. And they're screaming at me. They've got the solidarity fist up, and they're giving me a thumbs up. And we're both neck and neck, 65, 70 down the interstate, and they are just screaming their support at me because I had the recall Walker sticker on. So it's not just Wisconsinites who've been touched, but it's just all over. And this means so much for so many people. So I just wanted to let everyone know that it's just not this state. It's all over that this is exciting and people are really behind us.
Absolutely.
So Lynn, what is your most memorable story of all of this? If you had a year, we had the preparation, we had the go time, we had the 60 days of craziness, and even in the blog they were talking about people getting hot chocolate. I never got hot chocolate. I got the flip-off-a-thon. I didn't get a hot chocolate. But, you know, there it was just kind of nonstop. There was always something to do. So what's your most memorable story about all of this?
Oh, boy. I think there are quite a few. I think when we were, well, this is not a story that's really happened in the public. We were doing some strategic planning in July and in August with our own internal operations and with some of our partners to make some decisions about, you know, how to do this. Were we really going to do this, and how were we going to do it, and when were we going to pull the trigger? Were we going to go right away on the November 5th, on November 15th, in the spring, in the winter? You know, lots of things to ponder that we had no business pondering them, because there was no evidence to go on. There was no history to go on. We were, even at the strategic planning sessions, making history. And something I will never forget is when we came to an agreement as a diverse group that we were going to pull the trigger on November 15th. I will never forget. As a matter of fact, it just happened again. My stomach just fell through the floor, and my heart was in my throat. And that was because we were going to do it. We were going to do it with labor and with the Democratic Party of the state of Wisconsin and with some other grassroots. And we had, I mean, all the discussion, all the planning, it all comes to fruition when the group comes to consensus and says, yep, now it's happening. And the entire, everything changed. You know, we went from doing all sorts of development and growing to execution. And it was like flipping a switch. And, yeah, my stomach just fell to the floor again, even though we've succeeded and turned in. That night when we made that decision, I couldn't sleep that night. I don't know. I think I was partly terrified about what we were taking on and partly just completely excited that we were going to try to make history. And I have to tell you, lots of people said this couldn't be done nationally. We knew it could be as a grassroots organization because we were hearing already from county coordinators and volunteers all over the state. And I never thought that we couldn't do it. Like I said, I was just terrified about doing it right and doing right by the people of Wisconsin who wanted to get it done.
Barb, we have about a minute left. What's your most memorable moment for collecting signatures for this for the recall?
Well, you know, it has to be that I was given a pretty unique opportunity to be at the rally to recall Walker in Madison, and I couldn't afford the trip, but my brother from Minnesota volunteered to take me down. And we went down together, and I got to be one of the five or six speakers that addressed the crowd. And to watch the people there signing petitions there in that huge throng of people, it was just overwhelming, and it just made it all seem so real to me.
Well, you guys have all been amazing. I want to thank Barb for all her actions, and I'm so sorry to hear about your situation, but you know what? We'll get him out. We'll get a governor who's going to move the state forward, and we'll get you a job. So we'll get you, and health care, too. We'll get you working, Barb. We will. That's part of what we're doing here is moving our state forward. Lynn, thank you so much for everything you've done. You guys have been great. If it wasn't for at least the starting of the organization, we wouldn't have the county coordinators to talk to. And I want to thank everybody who put their effort and their heart and their soul into getting this done. 1,009.9 signatures and six people recalled. We will get our state moving forward. So thank you guys so much for everything.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank you all for listening to the Sarah Schultz Show today. I'd like to thank my producer, Bill, for all his hard work on the show this week, as always. You can download the show from iTunes, or you can listen to the archive shows at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. You can also listen to the Sarah Schultz Show off the Sarah Schultz Show app for Androids and iPhones. It's a free app you can download. Listen to all the archive shows. You tune in Saturday at 6 p.m. to Citywide, WIDE 99.1 FM in Madison. and on Tuesday at 1 p.m. to WHYS 96.3 FM in Eau Claire. Remember, Wisconsin forward, together forward. Have a great week, everyone. 1.9 million signatures.